Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about everything having to do with writing. Tonight, my fascinating guest is Natalie Anger, author of Woman, an Intimate Geography. She's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her science writing for the New York Times and author of Beauty of the Beastly, New Views on the Nature of Life and Natural Obsessions, Striving to Unlock the Deepest Secret of the Cancer Cell, all published by Houghton Mifflin. In addition to the Pulitzer Prize, Natalie Anger has won the Lewis Thomas Award, the American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Award, and the Barnard College Distinguished Alumna Award. Her articles for the New York Times cover subjects ranging from molecular biology to animal infidelity. They're among the most popular staples of the paper. Prior to her work for the Times, she covered science news for Time magazine and was a staff writer for Discover. Natalie Anger earned her BA with high honors at Barnard, studying literature, physics, and astronomy. She studied journalism and news writing at the City University of New York and New York University, and she's taught science writing at New York University's Graduate School of Journalism. She lives in Maryland with her husband and daughter, and her book, Woman, an Intimate Geography, which we'll be speaking about tonight, was nominated for a National Book Award. Welcome, Natalie. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
Your book, Woman, is wonderful, and it's interesting that you won the Lewis Thomas Award, because his book, Life of a Cell, is the last book of this kind that I read that was just wonderfully readable and was about biology, basically. I mean, your book is about more than that, but I'm curious how your book came to be.
Well, I actually have been writing about biology from a female perspective for some time now, and just got interested in, you know, the way a lot of evolutionary biologists, female evolutionary biologists, were starting to look at life from the female's perspective, because for many years it was kind of ignored. And so I got very interested in that and started writing a lot about female biology. And I also became concerned because I felt there was a lot of misinformation out there, or a lot of kind of glib stereotyping that was going on, that with the new popularity of Darwinism, that a lot of things were being said about human nature for which there was really pretty scanty evidence. And so as somebody who really loves evolutionary theory and loves biology, I thought that a lot of it was starting to sound rather like a kind of a burlesque or a lampoon of male and female behavior. So I decided to kind of pull it all together. And another trend that was going on, the women's health movement, as wonderful as I think it's been for women and to have attention cast on you know, their medical problems, I also feel like the women's health movement is given this impression that somehow women are prone to sickness, because health movements are often about diseases. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of talk about all sorts of women's diseases, and so I wanted to write about what went right with the female body rather than just what goes wrong with it. So that's kind of the perspective that I took, was to bring the body kind of alive from the inside out and to talk about female behavior from an evolutionary perspective, but not from one that is the typical perspective that you hear a lot these days. Mm-hmm. of the female as the one who's sort of looking for quality in a mate and sitting around, you know, hoping that she'll find some guy who can support her, basically. So I really wanted to talk about all the interesting, wonderful things that are going on in evolutionary theory that I didn't think were getting out there.
So what came first, your interest in science or your interest in writing?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer since I was, well, when I first started thinking. And I got interested in science not until college, when I thought that I needed that kind of perspective and the sharpening of the thinking that comes with it. I really loved physics and astronomy when I was in college, and I really got into taking a lot of hard science, and I didn't really know why. It wasn't like I planned on being a science writer, because I didn't. I just thought it was another way of knowing the world, and I really liked it. And I sort of felt like there were these, you know, what C.P. Snow called the two cultures, and I liked them both. And at that point, which was when I was in college back in the mid to late 70s, there wasn't really a lot of attempt to bring the two cultures together. So I thought, what I want to do is actually start a magazine, a popular science magazine. And that was my goal. But then when I got out of college and I worked for a little while in computers, and I heard, well, Time Incorporated was starting up just such a magazine, which then was Discover. So I started working for them instead of starting up my own magazine. But that was the idea, was that there's this really nice way of knowing the world that a lot of people in the humanities don't get exposed to enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, nonfiction is not normally thought of as a realm for the creative writer, and yet your writing is extremely creative. And I'm curious if you had to work at this, or have you always had a way with words and have been able to just make reading about biology or science fun?
Writing is really impossible. It just can't be done. And I think it's, no matter what kind of writing you're doing, it's really difficult. I think the way I look about writing about biology is I try to go out there and find out what's fascinating, like what's really interesting, and then I kind of try to absorb it and metabolize it and kind of work it through myself. It's almost like I have to kind of it first, rather than just, you know, find out about it and write it as though I'm a conduit. It's not like that. It's like I have to feel like I own the material. So it does, I do really think about it a lot. But my basic belief is that if you find it fascinating, chances are other people will too. So that's kind of what I do, is I go out there to find out interesting things or people who think about science and nature and human nature and female nature in an interesting way, in a kind of an unusual way. So I go out there to find people who have interesting things to say, and then to find out interesting facts that may not be known.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's that's my belief, is that if you find it fascinating and you share that, probably other people will too.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and I'm talking with Natalie Anger, author of Woman, an Intimate Geography. I read in Publishers Weekly in a story on you back in, I guess it was a March 22nd issue, that Woman is a missive to your daughter, a letter to be opened in the next century. Will you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think that, well, when I started the book before I had my daughter, or was even pregnant or knew I was going to have a daughter, so I had it in mind before that. But when I found out that I was having a daughter, it suddenly focused the whole purpose of it and kept me going through some very difficult times, because in writing about women's bodies, you know, it's a huge subject, and I felt sometimes like I couldn't finish it. And it was actually my husband who kept telling me that I wasn't doing it for me, I was doing it for her.
Mm-hmm.
And that really did keep me going, because I didn't want to disappoint her by not finishing. I mean, it's very, you try to find a million, when you're writing a book, a million and one excuses not to finish this. Oh, I'm going to just get back the advance, forget it, I can't do it. And I realized that if I did that, that, you know, it would be disappointing. I feel like girls still need a lot of help, or, you know, I was on a panel discussion recently, which was about girls and women and images of girls and women in the media, and I was sitting next to a young woman who has a website for girls, and there's a lot of this kind of girl movement going on, but I also feel at the same time that there's a lot of confusion, and there's this sense of, like, well, feminism is over, and we sort of have it all figured out, but I mean, girls know we don't have it figured out, and, you know, a lot of people know we don't have it figured out yet. And so the question is, how do we keep the forward momentum going so that my daughter, who's now 3, in the 21st century, will feel, like, optimistic possibility for her and for her daughters, and that it really is going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I wanted to do. Was, you know, I worry, of course, that when she's old enough to read it and understand it, she won't want to. I think that's what daughters do. But, you know, she may surprise me. I don't know.
Now, had you had a son, had you known you were going to have a son, how do you think that would have changed the project?
This is a fascinating question that I've asked myself. I said, what if it had been a boy? Then what would I do? Well, chances are it would have affected the audience I was addressing. Now, when I wrote the book, I wrote it with a female reader in mind and say as much in the introduction, and I address the reader as a gal, as a female. And I've been surprised that a lot of men have said that they really like the book, and some of the people who've reviewed it have been men who have said, you know, that don't count us out because we're interested in this subject too, not just of female nature but of human nature. I think if I had had a son, I probably would have written it with men as readers, as specifically, as well as women, like talking to them as well. That's just a guess, but I don't see how I could have avoided it, because I would have been thinking, what is my son going to be like as a man, and how is he going to feel about women? So these are still questions.
I would think, though, as you said, you've had men who have reviewed the book, and I would think any man who would want to know more about women inside out would just love this book. And you don't leave men out in this book either, which is nice about it.
I try not to, you know, it always gets into a kind of it's like a zero-sum game where if women win, men must lose, or that I must be saying women are better than men, or valorizing women at the expense of men, and I don't want to do that. I think that it's silly to do it, and, you know, I do make comparisons throughout the book. I usually try to keep it very light and good-humored, because I don't see any value in antagonism, although I do think that perhaps if you do take an evolutionary perspective, you can see how there is perhaps what, you know, one of the scientists I quote called the dialectic of the sexes. There's an inevitable tension between what the goals of the male are versus the goals of the female. But even with that inevitable dialectic or tension, you can still have what ends up like a lot of sort of agreement. And so I don't think of it as a war. I think of it as perhaps something that we have to be aware of, that there are going to be tensions, but that it doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad or that they're unresolvable or that, you know, they're necessarily going to lead to alienation between the sexes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the information in the book itself. There's so much good stuff. I know we're just never going to have time to get to all the questions that I have. But being the mother of a 5-year-old son, I was very interested in an early chapter in which you said that a boy inherits more genetically from his mother than from his father.
That's right.
Would you say a bit about that?
Well, this comes down to the fact that, I mean, you have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and 22 of them, you get one copy from your mother and one from your father. And in the case of the sex chromosomes, the X and the Y chromosomes, a son has his X chromosome from his mother, always, and his Y chromosome from his father. Now, the Y chromosome is much smaller than the X. I mean, it's physically smaller and also has far fewer genes on it. It's like, 40 or 50 genes on the Y chromosome versus maybe 5,000 or 6,000 on the X chromosome. So that Y that he got from his dad has, you know, so he's like, if you subtract 40 or 50 from 6,000, you see how many more genes he got from his mother than from his father. So he's more related to his mother than to his father. Now, a girl who has two X chromosomes one from her mom and one from her dad, is kind of equally related to her mother and father. So in that sense, you know, that the son is more like the mother, whereas the daughter is kind of equidistant from her mother and father. And it's interesting because who knows what it means? It may mean nothing in terms of our emotions, or it may say something about the relationship between the mother and son. It's an interesting difference, though.
Mm-hmm. I found something else interesting, which was to read in your book that some of the most beautiful women in the world, models and such, are androgen insensitive, born without complete female genitalia. And that, at this time, seems especially interesting because of what's going on in regards to the controversial website that's currently getting a lot of play on the auctioning of models' eggs.
Oh, right. Well, this is a condition that's very interesting, androgen insensitivity syndrome, where a fetus, I mean, every fetus is sexually bipotential. It can go either way. It has the equipment early on to become either male or female. And then at some point early in gestation, the Y chromosome has genes on it that switch on the program that build testes, and testes release androgens or male hormones, which then get rid of what would become female reproductive organs and instead start building the male reproductive organs. In women who have androgen insensitivity syndrome, they end up with, they have an X and a Y chromosome, so chromosomally they have the potential to be male, but their bodies are insensitive to the androgens that their little testes make during development. And because they're not sensitive to those androgens, they don't end up developing male organs. Instead, they develop what looks kind of like a female reproductive tract, but not, it's incomplete. Now, these women who, when they're born, are usually viewed as little girls because externally that's what they look like, and they may go through their childhood feeling, acting totally like any other little girl, but then at adolescence, because they don't have ovaries and they don't, they don't start menstruating, they don't have a uterus and so on, at that point it's usually discovered what's going on. But what happens because of their condition is they may end up growing taller than average, and they often have long legs. And because androgens in women, and women are sensitive to androgens, so they respond to them, androgens seem to be what, for example, keep the breasts from growing very large. So sometimes these women actually end up with very large breasts because they are producing the female hormones, which they are sensitive to, and they're producing the male hormones, which they're not sensitive to, so they basically can end up very buxom. They don't have pimples. They don't get bad skin because androgens in men and women both are what's responsible for acne. They often have very thick hair, beautiful thick hair, beautiful skin, long willowy body, busty body. I mean, it sounds like they're kind of perfect, and in fact, that's the kind of body that is very sought after in modeling and in acting and so on. So there's a number of famous people who do have, famous women who do have androgen insensitivity syndrome, and there are others who are suspected of having it. And so it's an interesting phenomenon that these women who look like superwomen, basically, are in fact, they're not fertile. They're infertile. They have no uterus. They don't make eggs. They're not capable of reproducing. But yet they have all the qualities that make them look very desirable. So to me, what this says is that a lot of this kind of glib Darwinian theory about what makes a woman attractive, I mean, we have to keep in mind that there's a lot of variations on a theme. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you know, that a woman who looks great is necessarily someone who's going to be a super baby maker.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's interesting about these women, they're insensitive to testosterone and other male hormones, and yet they have libidos. And you know, we talk about, well, you know, testosterone is the hormone of libido and so on. And it kind of, these women also underscore this simplicity of that model, that testosterone is necessary for sort of sexual desire, because
mm-hmm.
they have sexual desire without being responsive to testosterone.
Mm-hmm. You say in your book that menstruation may explain why women outlive men.
Yeah, this was a kind of a real, I mean, it's an interesting idea that just within the last 7 or 8 years, there's been a lot of theories presented about why women menstruate. I mean, we've always sort of just gone on taking it for granted all these years. Well, you know, we menstruate because, you know, we get the uterus ready, and if you don't have a baby, well, then we shed it, and that's the blood, and so on. And no one's ever thought about how weird it is that the system of doing that is the shedding of copious amounts of blood. And in our evolutionary past, to lose all of that blood and to lose all of those nutrients and to lose the iron in that blood, I mean, that just seems like a real waste. You can get rid of tissue in all sorts of ways, like you slough off your stomach lining without having, like, a lot of blood loss every day. So finally, Margie Proffitt, an evolutionary thinker, started saying, hey, wait a minute, why do we take it for granted that women should menstruate in this kind of exaggerated fashion? So she came up with this proposal that menstruation was a form of protection against pathogens that may have been hitching a ride in on sperm, so that the exposure to all of these viruses, bacteria, and so on, that the body basically uses this method of real serious cleansing of that. And because we are such a sexually active species, having sex all the time, that this would be a necessary way of getting rid of it. And she proposed that. A lot of people said, oh, hogwash, you know, they sort of got up in arms about it. But she stimulated a lot of good thinking about a process that we're all very familiar with that nobody had said anything about before.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that that this is a cleansing mechanism, so that we could say, well, it basically keeps women healthy. So I just kind of threw that out as a funny notion, that we're always coming up with all sorts of reasons why women outlive men. Well, maybe this is one more of them. But there's no proof for it, and I did try to do it in a way where it's like, you know, there's just, you can come up with any number of woolly theories, and here's another one.
Speaking of funny notions, again, your writing is very lively and punchy and funny. And in at certain points in the book, it's almost as if you're crafting a humor piece. Are you naturally funny, or is this, again, something that you something that you really work at? I mean, like the line, don't douche ever, period, end of squirt bottle. I find that very funny.
Well, in person, I'm definitely not one of these one-liner types. I mean, I have friends, and actually my brother and my mother are really good with these kind of one-liners, and they're always competing with each other to see who's funnier. And I could never do that at the dinner table, but in my writing, at least, I try to be funny. I like to be funny because, well, several reasons. When you're writing, you kind of have to do something to keep yourself going, you know? So it's like you have to amuse yourself. And then there's also the problem of humor as a way of lessening the tensions of... Humor is a really important social bonding material, so if I'm going to be saying something that maybe could be construed as, oh, polemical or hostile or whatever, you know, it's always a good idea to make a joke about it. So,
good point.
You know, I just try to do that rather than just getting up on a soapbox and saying, I know the answer.
Yes. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm speaking with Natalie Angier, author of Woman and Intimate Geography. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay tuned. We'll come back. I'll talk for another half hour with Natalie about her book, Woman. So do stay tuned for more interesting talk. Intimate geography. Natalie, you talk a lot about female aggression in this book and why women can be the best of friends and the worst of enemies. Would you tell us about this?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that we have such strong and conflicted feelings about other women, about girls. And I got interested in the subject of female aggression because, again, you know, you read things where these researchers in England say girls are more social than boys, and you know they make friends and they're nice to each other, and they come up with genetic reasons why. And I think, and I really get disturbed by this because, as someone who was a girl once, and I grew up in the Bronx, and you know it was tough being a girl, not just because it was the Bronx, but because there's so much jockeying for position and kind of battling in the hierarchy. And every girl, I think, knows this situation where you have, like, a best friend one day, and then the next day you're torn apart, or you may have, you know, a threesome where the two girls will be, you know, they kind of keep trading off which two are best friends and which is the one on the outs. And so there's all this very complicated stuff between girls and women. And also, I think women notice other women and feel perhaps more aggressive towards other women than they do towards men very often. And if you look at the history or the prehistory of female primates and how they relate to each other, and if you look at some of the old world monkeys, where every social group is a gynocracy, is female-centered, is organized around the females, where it may be a natural line, a mother with her daughters, or it may be, in the case of bonobo chimpanzees, unrelated females, but they kind of stick up for each other. And this is a source of incredible female strength among primates, that whenever a female has any kind of say in what she's going to do with her life, it's as a result of having a lot of other females around to protect her against males that are usually bigger and males who may not only want to hurt her but want to hurt her infants. So there's this kind of background, deep background in our past where females gained a lot of strength from other females. With humans, there's been a kind of a rupture of that, and instead what you see is much stronger alliances among males, among men, than you do in any other primate, even chimpanzees, where the males may sometimes form these alliances. But humans have taken it to glorious heights, where male alliances are the basis for so much of our society, and females have kind of lost that because so often a girl is taken away from her birthplace at marriage and she moves to her husband's house, and so she loses that source of strength from her female relatives. And so instead of females being a potential source of strength to you, they all of a sudden become an incredible threat, because mm-hmm. you need a woman. In our past has been more dependent on a man than any female primate has ever been on any male. I mean, female primates always feed themselves, you know, they have access to what they need to feed themselves and their young. Only in humans has there been this kind of, you know, there's a middleman, you know, there's a man that you need to go through to get just the basics to stay alive. So all of a sudden, that female who could take away your man, let's say, has the potential not just to take away a mate, but to take away your entire livelihood, really, is what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this intense conflict, more competitiveness between women, I think, than you would see between two unrelated female chimpanzees.
Mm.
So what I think is going on is this very strong conflict between, on the one hand, our past, which is mostly a kind of a female-centered one, and a much newer human history of intense competition among women. So I think that that kind of that sense of being split about, as one of the women I quote from, I can't remember what century, 17th, 18th century, you know, a woman can be, you know, the biggest, do you the most harm, but also the greatest good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how we feel, that on the one hand, we're very aggressive towards each other. On the other hand, I think we realize the potential for female solidarity as a source of strength, and it is in non-human primates.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a lot going on there. And I also argue that female solidarity in humans has been, whenever women have gotten anything done, whether it's the suffragist movement or anything, it's always been through a form of sisterhood, that is, again, the primate way to have strength. You can't go it alone. And so I argue that this is perhaps a lesson that we can learn from, too.
Mm.
And other female primatologists that I have interviewed feel the same way, that what they see in the species that they observe indicates to them that, for example, if a male comes in and he starts trying to hurt one of the infants, wow, those female baboons, it's like they come out of everywhere and attack him because they know that, you know, he maybe will try to kill this infant. And so female primatologists, I think, feel that there's a basic template here that we also, as primates, perhaps it resonates with us.
Hmm. What about, say, women who hurt their children, kill their children? What do you have to account for this? I mean, it seems that they're an aberration of nature.
Well, you
or
know,
not.
I don't talk too much about that in my book, but there's this new book out by Sarah Hurdy called Mother Nature, where she goes into this quite a bit, and it's a fascinating book. And she talks about humans, human mothers as being a real aberration, in that a chimpanzee mother or a gorilla mother has never been observed that a female gorilla or chimpanzee will abandon her infant or kill it. I mean, others might try to kill it. Other females might try to kill it, and other males will try. But a mother herself will never sort of look at a baby and say, this one is just not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get rid of it. Even if the baby seems to have some terrible birth defect, they do not kill the baby. Humans do. Well, Sarah Hurdy thinks that it's because of changes in our sort of birth spacing, for example, that humans, not only do we have a much longer period of dependency than you see in the other primates, but we have a shorter birth interval, so that when you talk about a chimpanzee, she doesn't give birth every 2 years or every 3 years. She gives birth maybe once every 6 or 7 years.
Hmm.
With humans, we become more like, as Sarah Hurdy puts it, more like a litter-bearing species, even though those litters may be a couple of years apart. But in cases of female mammals like a cat or a pig or whatever, they sometimes will kill their own offspring. So we're kind of like more like that than we are like most of the other apes.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are so stressed and pressured, and our birth spacing has become so short. And she actually sees that as, she blames it in part on, on demands of men to want to increase their progeny, and, you know, the agricultural revolution and all of these forces that led to, I mean, the thought of a woman who has 15 or 20 kids in her lifetime, he'd take a gorilla, I mean, you know, maybe 6, 7 maximum, but, you know, I mean, the thought of having 15 or 20 kids, you really do start to feel more like, more like a dog with puppies.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Natalie Angier, author of Woman and Intimate Geography. You say estrogen is like chocolate. Almost every two-bit organ or tissue wants a bite of it. Yet you don't think well of hormone replacement therapy, which is what many women are doing these days.
Well, it's not that I don't think well of it. I think that, first of all, estrogen is a wonderful hormone. I think it's fascinating, and the more we learn about it, the more complicated it seems. And, you know, we used to think of it as basically a female reproductive hormone, but now it turns out to be, you know, every organ in the body is sensitive to it and responds to it, and a lot of them depend on it. It's a very important hormone. At the same time, one of the things I object to is this idea of menopause as a disease, and the model of menopause as a deficiency state, like diabetes, like thyroid disease. It's been compared to that, and I talk about what some of the evolutionary evidence is for whether or not we are really sort of supposed to die before reaching menopause, and therefore, if you live past menopause, it's by grace of modern medicine. Therefore, you should be taking hormones. So I look at some of the evidence that suggests that, in fact, humans have been selected to have quite a long life, post-reproductive, post-menopausal life. So obviously, we can do without hormone replacement therapy. And so I'm not sure that that argument holds up. Mm-hmm. So I try to say maybe menopause is not this kind of catastrophic event that it's been presented as, and maybe hormone replacement therapy is not something that you have to do for your whole postmenopausal life, which can be quite long. Mm-hmm. I mean, women now can live, you know, 30, 40, 50 years after menopause.
Right.
And so do we want to be taking estrogen for that many years? Well, the risk of breast cancer does seem to be related to the amount of time that you're taking hormone replacement therapy. So maybe we can stagger it, or maybe we can start it later. You know, we don't necessarily have to say, oh, my God, here you are.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, they're talking about the perimenopausal years when you're in your 40s, and maybe you should be taking it even earlier and just keep going. And so I question whether or not this is something that women all want to do. And also I question the universal model of hormone replacement therapy as a panacea for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, no drug is meant for, you know, everybody.
Yes.
So I'm not against hormone replacement therapy by any means, and I think each woman has to make her decision. But I am against this model of menopause as this catastrophic disease, this image of this woman who's just going to, you know, either crumble because her bones dissolve or have a heart attack the minute she, you know, this idea. That's what I most object to.
What is the most startling discovery you made in researching this book?
Well, there were a number of them. I mean, to me, the idea that the clitoris, just a simple little fact that I learned about how the clitoris has twice as many nerve fibers in it as the penis, and this to me was an amazing, just a, four, you know, 8,000 versus 4,000.
And yet you say there's something like two books written about it?
The clitoris is an amazingly understudied organ, considering. If you look up in Medline or you try to find out people who have studied just even understanding the basic structure of it, there's still discoveries being made about the basic and sort of cellular structure, just the whole way in which the clitoris is designed. You read these papers where you think, why is this paper coming out in 1994? It should have come out in 1954, right? but there's very little research done about female sexuality generally. It's very hard in this country to get money to do that kind of research. It is so hard. So there's so many unknowns. You know, female sexual dysfunction is just not studied that much. People are afraid to study it. They're afraid that, you know, people are going to come along and think that, you know, it's pornography or whatever. And look at the vibrator. The vibrator is this great thing for women who are having trouble having orgasms, and yet in a number of states, it's outlawed. It's just a crazy thought, but, you know, a woman's orgasm is not considered to be essential, so that if the fact that 40% of American women don't have orgasms regularly is not seen as being a medical problem worth studying, even though, I mean, when Viagra came out, it immediately was just, you know, soared to, like, one of the biggest selling drugs of all time. So the, you know, female side of the equation is too often ignored.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write Woman?
How long?
Yeah.
Well, the problem was I had this baby in the middle. That kind of made things very slow for a while. But I'd say from start to finish, it was probably, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. It was a long time. But and it was, you know, it just seemed like it went as fast as it could.
And in terms of then the revision process and all that, do you go through an entire draft? Did you go through an entire draft of this book before you went back to revise, or do you do that as you go along?
I tend to be one of these revise as I go along. I mean, there were several chapters that my editors demanded more substantial revisions of, and so, you know, I had to go back and work on them. But I tend to be, I'm not one of these people who can sort of write a rough first draft.
Mm-hmm.
I write kind of sentence by sentence, and if I'm not satisfied, it's hard for me to go to the next sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, I envy writers I know who will go through and do a rough draft, and because it's so much easier when you have something to work with. It's really, I know that as someone who's also edited other people's stuff, that it's so much easier to be an editor than a writer,
mm-hmm.
and it's because it's there in front of you,
right.
instead of it's just, you know, the blank screen. So it's much easier that way, and my husband, who's also a writer, always does that. He writes, you know, a first draft, and then he goes back and revises it. But I've never been able to do that.
I'm curious. I'm always curious with authors and their books, and the first chapter. Your first chapter is called Unscrambling the Egg. It begins with one perfect solar cell, and I'm curious if that was always the first chapter of this book.
The egg?
Yeah. Or did that happen, did that come along later?
That's a good question. You know, I think it wasn't the first chapter originally, but I don't remember what was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, structuring the book was hard, and so, you know, just working that out took a while. But if there was a chapter before the egg, it was certainly not something that I was very committed to, because I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, well, I was forced to take it out and I'm still bitter.
Well, how involved did your editor get with your book in terms of restructuring or revising, or, you know, real involved, not that involved?
Well, it was funny because the editors, my original editor, Peter Davison, who has the imprint that published the book, he actually retired before the book was finished. So, about two-thirds of the way through it, another woman, Laura Van Dam, came onto the project, and she was new to the publisher. She was to Houghton Mifflin. She came from Technology Review. She came from a magazine background into books. And so she kind of stepped right into this book that was mostly done at that point and took over. So I felt as though it kind of had two midwives, if you will,
mm-hmm.
seeing it to completion. And that actually worked out well, because Peter was a really great editor, but then I kind of had a woman come in
mm-hmm.
and give it that perspective, and I was grateful for that.
I'm curious how winning the Pulitzer Prize in 1991, and now, of course, the nomination for the National Book Award, how that's affected your life or your career as a writer, really. I mean, how are the challenges still the same, or do you feel a little relief?
No, because, you know, I mean, you're only as good as your next whatever. The Pulitzer, that was a, you know, that was good just in terms of giving me, it definitely helps, you know, as a calling card. And I mean, the National Book Award nomination is really nice, and I'm pleased with it because it's for, you know, for the book rather than for sort of more generally, like the Pulitzer was for a series of articles, so it was kind of a more general thing. But this was something specific, and you know, but you always feel like, I mean, you've always got to prove yourself, and you also worry that you're losing it, the big it, so that you're not gonna, you can't just sort of rest on anything. You could write something tomorrow that's just terrible, and you know, I know how I feel. Like I can be very kind of cruel and judgmental about reading people's stuff, and I know they're doing that to mine too, because I do it to others. And so you know that on the one hand, you know, when you love someone, you love them. On the other hand, if they disappoint you, if they write something that disappoints you, you feel almost personally affronted about it. So you know, it's like you're always trying to somehow live up to some imaginary standard that you don't even really, you can't even articulate in your own mind, but you're kind of always grasping towards it. And that's something that you can never, that's not going to go away until you stop writing.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading now? What do you read?
I read a combination of, I read a huge amount for my work, so I'm always reading, I'm reading scientific journals all the time, I'm reading books, science books, stuff, you know, downloaded from the web and so on. But I also read a lot of fiction to just to kind of, again, that other perspective you need in life. So I actually just finished not long ago reading the latest book by John Horgan I really liked, The Undiscovered Mind. I found that to be quite engaging, and I just kind of zipped through that. And you know, I'll read Italo Calvino, which is what I'm doing right now. And so it's quite a mix.
Who were your influences, your writing influences, when you were becoming a writer?
When I was becoming a writer, I was influenced by a number of, a combination of fiction writers and science writers. Some of my favorite science writers early on were people that are not that read now, like this guy, George Gamow, who wrote these wonderful books called Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland about, you know, this guy who basically took trips through these, he would fall asleep and dream about these worlds where all of these very difficult principles of physics were being acted out. And George Gamow was a physicist, but I was really influenced by this idea that you could sort of tell a story or a fantasy and through that still get your points across. I think Tracy Kidder's book, The Soul of a New Machine, was a real turning point for a lot of us and had a huge impact. And The Double Helix by Jim Watson, and this guy, Burton Ruscha, you ever read him?
Mm-mm.
The medical detective?
No.
Oh, wonderful collection of pieces that he wrote for The New Yorker. He died a few years ago, but these were just these medical detective stories that were fantastic. And all of these writers had a real influence on how I thought about structuring stories, how to pull the reader in.
Well, we have come to the end of our time. I wonder, though, if you have any words of wisdom for the writers listening.
I really feel that you just have to put one foot in front of the other. When I used to teach, journalism and writing, and I used to tell people, and I try to follow this advice myself, never think about the big picture. Mm. Like, always just look at the word, right? You know, it's like you put one word in front of another, and you just never think, because if you start thinking about the big picture, that's it. That's the, you're going to be stuck with sort of a crippling writer's block. But if you just write one word after another, pretty soon you've walked all the way across the room. So that's the way I try to do it. Just like, I guess that's the kind of the AA philosophy, one day at a time.
That's a great way to think of it.
Yeah.
For writers that, yeah, it can be daunting. I so appreciate having you on the show,
thank you.
And I wish you lots of luck with your with the book and your nomination.
Great.
And I love the book, and thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. That was Natalie Anger, author of Woman, An Intimate Geography, again recently nominated for a National Book Award. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, email me at bdemarcob@aol.com, or write to me in care of the station, P.O. Box 4362, Irvine, 92616. The show is internet accessible at kuci.org. Visionaries is on next with Ava Park. Next week, my guest will be Susan Perry, best-selling author of Writing in Flow. Thank you for listening, and take care. And please remember, it's all about putting one foot in front of the other, and about writing like there is no tomorrow.